This is the EcoFiles, conversations from the MRU Sustainability Forum. My name is Kayla Flindle.
And my name is Darlene Aquino. One theme that came out of the 2024 Sustainability Forum at MRU was social good.
Now you may be wondering, what is social good?
Well, social good, or common good, is defined as what is shared and beneficial to a large number of people.
A way the UN tries to bring about the common good is through SDGs.
SDGs are Sustainable Development Goals with 17 objectives to create a more sustainable future, established in 2015. It's a call to action to create a healthier world by 2030.
To unpack a piece of social good, such as AI, I spoke to Hadi Farbrozi, an assistant professor of innovation and entrepreneurship at MRU, about his knowledge on AI uses and what the future holds.
But before we get to that interview, I spoke with Rachel Pettigrew about how to maintain sustainability in diverse workplaces as assistant professor and chair of Bizet School of Business. Pettigrew focuses on how to sustainably incorporate and manage diversity in workplaces, ultimately fostering gender and racial inclusivity. Here's my conversation with her. Can you provide a short summary of your background and career in terms of inclusivity or workplace culture?
I have the bulk of my work in research area has been in kind of an interdisciplinary exploration of workplace organizational culture and organizational and legislated policies that support people's balance of both their work and family lives. So I have done a lot of work on legislative policies like parental leave and maternity leave, looking at how employers respond to or work interruption bias that people might face when taking leave. I also have worked in kind of the inclusivity space and organizational culture by working on projects like my recent SHRC-funded project on women and gender diverse folks, inclusion and board work. And also I have a secondary research stream that looks at newcomers, so recent immigrants and their employment and inclusion in workplaces. With a couple of projects looking at rural settlement of newcomers and employment in those areas, and then also the treatment of seasonal agricultural workers during COVID. So all the 60,000 people we bring to Canada to support our agricultural industry.
What inspired you to have this focus?
So I'm interested both at the dynamics that happen in workplaces, both from kind of a sociological perspective, but also a business perspective. So a lot of research focuses on employees in business as kind of line items, like in the budget, right? And so I look at employees as people that have care responsibilities and full lives outside work. And so a lot of my research, I think, looks both at it from the employee perspective, but also the management perspective. Because sometimes you'll have people say, well, employers should offer this, this, and this. But if they do that, they won't have profit, right? But employers need to be a little bit more compassionate with how they engage and recruit their employees. And so I kind of meet in the middle with those two bodies of research. But I think I began my work-life balance research long before I had kids, but having kids has made me realize just how important some of the topics that I'm talking about are.
That's a very inspiring to hear, coming from like a business perspective too. It's very wonderful that you have that sort of drive. From your perspective, have you seen any progress or meaningful change in inclusivity over the years?
Yeah, so when I finished my PhD at University of Manitoba in 2014, and my dissertation at the time was looking at, which I started probably working on in 2011, was looking at men's use of parental leave in workplaces. So I was looking at the organizational culture, managers' attitudes, and coworker behavior that influenced whether or not men would take leave or not. So when I was asking companies to be involved in that survey in 2010, it was actually really hard. It was considered kind of an upstream topic. Men and care and men taking leave was kind of not being discussed in the same way. Over time, now we see that men are much more, the prevalence of men taking leave hasn't skyrocketed, but policies have shifted and changed to allow men. And it seems like there's a greater societal discourse on men taking leave. So I would say it's improved over the last 10 or 15 years. And I'm planning probably in the next year or two to do a follow-up survey to my initial project.
with your work on parental leave policies and caregiving, that's very interesting. Do you think that these policies have the power to shift traditional workplace dynamics or even societal views on sort of caregiving roles?
So when we talk about parental leave, maternity and parental leave, maternity is that recovery from physical delivery. So the birthing parent would use that leave. And then parental leave can be shared by either parent in a co-parent situation. So the policies, there's kind of three or four levels to what impacts who takes what. And so the first level is there's the legislation and what policy is open to who, right? In 2000 was the first time men actually had access to parental leave. And then about 10% of leave takers were men. And we're now like at 13% or something like that. So there's only been an incremental time since the establishment of men's access. So there's the legislative policy and how it's set up to determine who can take it. Then there's kind of societal and relational expectations. So in any partnership, like what the general expectations are in that specific partnership. So that's one level. And then there's the conduct at work. So for example, in a heterosexual couple, you might have, they might have very traditional gender role division of care mindset. And so the wife might stay home and the husband might go to work. Or you might have someone with who they might share it 50-50 because the woman's equally engaged in her career and doesn't want to be gone for the full year. So that their friend network, their parents' expectations, their partner's expectations influence their choices around leave and also their financial. So their big impact is, you know, who can take leave and spend time with the child without negatively impacting our bank account. So that there's relational aspects and then there's work aspects, right? So you might have a really engaged dad who wants to take 6 months off with their newborn child, but work is going, they know that it would be challenging and it might impact the trajectory of their career. And so they choose not to. So there's multiple factors. There's a legislative access, there's relational and financial. And then there's also kind of the workplace implications. I think we are having more conversations around use of leave. And I think dads may, depending on industry, be more likely to access a parental leave now than ever before. But the type of industry, the type of culture in their specific workplace has a huge impact on whether or not they take up those advantages.
And do you know how or like who puts these policies into place?
Yeah, so we have federal legislation. So the federal government comes up with legislative policies, and then there are some variations. So when we think of parental leave, there's actually two parts, maternity and parental leave. There's two parts. There is the leave itself. So how long you can take off work, how much warning you need to give an employer that you're going on leave, the rules around returning to work. So for example, maternity and parental leave in Alberta, you just need to give 90 days notice that you're going to take leave. And then they have to, if as long as you've worked there for a given amount of time, they need to observe that leave. And they also can't penalize you for taking leave. So upon return, you need to be given your existing job or one of equivalent pay or responsibility upon your return. But then how other things are implemented, like qualifications and things like that, are provincially, there's oversight at the provincial. So there's some variation province. And then the other part, so there's a leave and how long you're going to be gone. And then there's the EI replacement. So there's the employment insurance wage replacement that you receive while on leave. And that is all federally legislated, though there's some implications at policy level at the provincial legislation area. It is important to note that the federal government cares about this because they want to ensure part of the motivation around the one-year maternity leave is actually kind of the health of children. So, and also establishing that parent-child relationship is important, but also parents who have access to parental leave end up maintaining their relationship to the paid labor force. But the motivation is to maintain new parents, to ease the stress on new parents, to maintain the health and well-being of the child and parent, and then also maintain connection to the labor force.
But even with these policies, employees can still like face biases even when they take time off. So what strategies have you seen to address that?
Recently, in a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, the federal government extended parental parental leave from maternity parental leave combined from 1 year to a year and a half. Employment insurance remains unchanged. So if you take the year and a half, you're getting the same dollar amount, but it's just getting spread out over a year and a half. And that raised a lot of concerns. And so I did a research project where I interviewed 46 companies about how they use parental leave, their perception of the extended parental leave, and how that might impact employees' careers. Anytime we're away from work for a period of time, it's going to have an impact on our career trajectory. We hope it doesn't. And it really depends on the kind of employer, their organizational culture, and the willingness and support of managerial staff that are there. So it can be handled really well. And when you think of it, healthcare or education, where you have a female dominant workforce, they're really used to people coming and going and having leaves and other kinds of things. In many cases, in male dominant spaces or where you have very few people taking leave every year, they don't always know how to handle it as well. And some organizational cultures just have that demand for face time. So you're valuable if you're in the office from, you know, 7 a.m. to 6 o'clock. Those kinds of cultures will be really hard with long-term absences. So I did the research project asking these 46 companies if extending to a year and a half was going to be a challenge or would impact negatively on their careers. And I hate to say that the news was not terrific. Some organization, about 50% of the organization said that it could have an impact. And that's hard to hear, given that women are primary users of parental leave. So women still use around 85 to 90% of parental leave. And so what really revealed itself is that there was a little bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't approach, because the employers would talk about, like, it's hard if you're really early in your career to take that time off because that might affect the trajectory of your career. So you want to establish yourself before you take leave. But then on the flip side, some of the folks would say, yes, but if you're like a manager and you're 35 and you take leave, you have responsibilities, and stepping away for a long period of time is really challenging. In Canada now, our fertility rate is actually 1.3. So it's lower than ever before. And so it remains a challenge, but the implications of work interruption bias are still there. And so one of the ways that we can kind of contradict that is women and men sharing, or same-sex couples sharing their leave, means that both people kind of share the impact on their career, but the absence that the employer has to backfill them for is shorter. So each person takes 6 months, then the employer has you for, you know, they haven't lost you for a year. The husband or a partner can build mastery. So men who use parental leave build mastery in parenting. They have better life satisfaction. They build early connection. It contributes to marital satisfaction because there's a lot of empathy when in heterosexual relationships, when the male partner stays home, they kind of get what the level of responsibility when they're solo parenting. And so it can be, there's 100 ways. And I also think that men who take leave are more compassionate managers when they have employees who then take leave. I think encouraging more equal division of the use of parental leave is a strong measure. I think employers who really invest in time to create policies that support people during that trajectory of pre-departure, departure, and return from leave, we'll reap the rewards of that support.
And when looking at sort of the minorities, including newcomers, what unique challenges do workplaces face in fostering inclusivity with people from different backgrounds?
I teach a class here on campus called Organizational Development and Cultural Calibration. And we talk about, the second half of the class talks about ways in which we need to build inclusive spaces. And so we address like newcomer engagement and employment. We talk about 2S LGBTQIA support and inclusion in the workplace, and Indigenous relations, engagement, and retention. And so the steps that we take to support all folks and build inclusive spaces benefits everyone in the space. So if we're building a workplace that supports neurodivergency, we're likely going to support anybody else in the organization who will benefit from those policies and practices in that inclusive workspace.
That was really good. I liked the theme of making the world a better place for future generations.
Mm-hmm. And
I look forward to hearing about the strengths and weaknesses of AI in today's society.
Well, after speaking with Hattie at the 2024 MRU Sustainability Forum, he gave a talk titled AI in Our Hands, The Future We Create or Destroy. Here's my conversation with them. So, what does sustainability mean to you?
Well, honestly, it's a complex word that we use for many different things now. But to me, sustainability means that balanced approach that, everyone refers to these SDGs that the UN sets for sustainability, looking at a balance of environmental, human, education, all of that. But I think, you know, we really don't appreciate how important the balance is between all these aspects. Like for me, things such as access and equity and get access in education and, welfare or ending hunger, these things I think are as important as, you know, taking care of the planet. Where, you know, if you apply a very North American or, you know, well-off countries view to this sustainability, it tends to focus a lot on just the planet side of things. And at least that has been my feeling. But overall, I think it's very important to have that balanced approach to, you know, all the different goals that have been set for sustainability.
Of course, you know, it's really important to have that balance, I think, too. And there is a wide spectrum for sustainability, and it's definitely important to have equality throughout all of those. So I want to move on to, what is AI?
Mm-hmm. Again, it's a lot of things that we put under this umbrella term AI. It's really, for me, it's a difference between, you know, having a dumb computer as opposed to a smart computer. A dumb computer is, you know, all these things that we currently have, where you tell the computer what to do and it does it for you. But yeah, all the advancements that we have had generally over the past decades have been, okay, let's do this job that you want to get done faster and faster. The smart computers, aka AI, is where it tries to emulate your thinking. It tries to think, but you just give it some sort of a prompt or a command or, you know, a general definition of what you want, and then it knows how to put things together. And then, of course, it learns from how you decide, how you think, how people have made decisions in the past, and tries to emulate that. And slowly but surely, we built that, and it can now emulate our most complex creations, things such as language. Like, it can emulate language with, like, generative AI like ChatGPT. It can actually write and talk in all the languages that we as human beings have created. So yeah, that's how I define AI.
That's really interesting. So how do you think AI can aid global issues?
Well, that's a very positive spin to this. Anytime I want to talk about the effect of AI in global issues, I have no choice but to see both the positive and negative. On the aiding side is that as human beings, we have a lot of limitations, like in the ways that we can imagine solutions to problems, in the ways that we implement our solutions to the problems that many of them have been created by ourselves. But I think the biggest thing that AI can help with is to decide faster and to decide better, hopefully. And that is in case we train and build good AI. So just to put it into a comparison, there is a really significant point in the history of development of AI back in 1998 when Deep Blue, this machine that can play chess, beats Garry Kasparov, which is the world, you know, genius in playing chess. So beating the master of masters, you know, in human terms, by a computer back in 98, that just showed, you know, how capable they are. And the way this machine could beat Kasparov was because it could imagine hundreds of thousands of strategies at any point of the game, and very fast, and then, you know, see how things might unfold. They say that a good chess player can predict, you know, the next 20 moves on the board. Mm-hmm. You know, a good AI could perhaps predict the next 200. And then, you know, the capabilities just grow more and more. Like, you know, if you ask, for example, ChatGPT now to go and craft a detailed, you know, article on this, if you give it enough information, enough details, it can do a very good job in a fraction of the time that takes the smartest human beings. And we haven't even seen the start of development these AI models. They're just growing, becoming bigger, becoming more capable. And so you get the idea, it becomes smarter and smarter. Mm-hmm. And this is on the positive side. And then, you know, there's a lot of things on the negative side. It's like, you know, if we assume that they are built for good and they do good, they can obviously help us solve a lot of our complex problems. But on the other hand, they can be, you know, abused for many different bad purposes, you know, which can have very drastic results.
So on the topic of that, what issues do you think are possibly becoming worse because of AI within the world?
Yeah. So first of all, I think there are a couple things that are becoming worse. First of all, is that AI is not like, there is this false image of AI running on the cloud, and cloud being this breezy, nice place, which is super cool, super cold, and, you know, you're just walking on the cloud, and, you know, our data is stored there and runs. Whereas in reality, it's not. It's, you know, cloud is nothing but giant factories filled with tons of servers which burn a lot of fuel. It's like football pitch after football pitch full of racks of servers. If anyone has ever walked into a server room, they will know that it's a lot more like hell as opposed to being in the cloud. And it's very hot, it burns a lot of energy, it consumes water. Like this giant GPUs, graphical processing units that run out AI commands, they consume a lot of power and a lot of water. Like, you know, they literally run the river through these data centers just because, you know, we are asking the next knock-knock joke on ChatGPT. And that's, I think that's really sad. So, and that's one aspect of it, of course. And then the other aspect is, I don't think anyone is being very careful with how we develop AI. It's just open, out, and, you know, everyone with any intentions can get their hands on it, and then they can develop a lot of bad things with AI. Like, what if someone's whole idea of using AI is to, you know, hack into people's data, hack into people's bank accounts data? You know, these machines are becoming stronger and stronger, and they can definitely do that. So it's, and I don't think we have thought about this well enough to implement solutions for it. The immediate thing that comes to many people's minds is like, is there a way to slow down its progress, or make, you know, ban it, or put the genie back in the bottle? That's not gonna happen. It's already out there. There is no going back to days before AI was in everybody's hands. So yeah, I think, you know, it can get really scary.
Yeah, no, AI is very implemented into our, who we are pretty much at this point. And because it's such a big thing now, what steps do you think we should take to make sure AI possibly has a positive impact on the world in the future?
I think, like, obviously, my thinking on this keeps evolving, right? Like, if you ask me this question a year ago, it would be something completely different. I think the first one is to promote and expand the resources and, you know, the accessibility of the open source path. Transparency is really key in how these models are trained and how, you know, what has been used, the process. The second one is education, I guess. And it's like, the idea is that 95% of the people in the whole world are very good people. They have no intentions of harming anyone. They want peace. They want just, you know, living a peaceful, happy, simple life. And for that reason, and they want to contribute something meaningful to the world. So for that reason, if you make this education and access to AI as accessible and as wide as possible, then there would be more good people to build good AI. This is exactly what happened to the internet when it became accessible everywhere. There were a lot of good people that created good content. Compare that with a fraction of the content on the internet which are harmful and bad, you will see that, you know, good really overcomes. So I really believe in this power of community. And, you know, if you make it accessible, if you make it free, if you make it open source, and if you provide the education to people, I believe in the power of the crowd, the masses, as opposed to the few greedy corporates who are building bad. And then, of course, the harm, meaning people that want to do bad things with AI. So that's, I think, is sort of this. I don't know the solution, but I think it is the path forward towards some positive.
Do you have any hopes for AI? Or like, what are your hopes for the future of sustainable AI?
Yeah, I do have a lot of hopes. I have a 5-year-old kid. I want to see her live in a you know, clean city with, you know, most of the issues that we deal with today are not there. I'm hoping that once and for all, super complex issues that we could not have solved as human beings can be solved with the help of AI. Things such as war, like if you think about it, no matter how hard our politicians and war criminals try to justify any act of war, there is zero reason for any war in any part of the world. You know, they make up all sorts of excuses. Oh, you came into my border. Oh, you did this to me or that. But if you go back to the history of war, all of them are honestly very stupid. There is zero reason to kill anyone else. It's just all an attempt of power grab or being greedy. It's like, you know, what's the point? Like, they become easily more and more complex, and we are just not seeing the solutions that could be very clear. I think with training unbiased AI agents that can consider all the solutions that we could not have seen, and then with the example I give in my classes is like, imagine a conference where you have an AI trained in philosophy, an AI trained in history, in hunger, in energy, in politics, in whatever science that we have created, and they debate the matters, our most complex matters like war, hunger, all of this, or borders, you know, refugees, immigration, all these very complex issues. And they can work on it tirelessly thousands of times, hundreds of thousands of times faster than us. You know, they can create better solutions. I'm hopeful for that. Of course, with hopes comes the fear that, you know, if we don't do this, and do this fast enough, there would be enough people and enough powerful people to abuse this. create more espionage, create more warfare, and start tracking people and, you know, doing harmful things.
Well, thank you, Kayla, for sharing that discussion.
Thanks, Darlene, and thank you for sharing yours.
Thanks to our amazing guests, Hattie Farabrosi and Rachel Pettigrew, for making time to talk to us and for their excellent work on sustainability in the future of society.
Thanks also to Mauricio Latapi for organizing the MRU Sustainability Forum and connecting us with our guests.
This episode of the Ecofiles, Conversations from the MRU Sustainability Forum, was written, hosted, and produced by me, Darlene Aquino.
And me, Kayla Fundel.
This podcast was recorded on an ancient and storied land steeped in ceremony and history that, until recently, was occupied exclusively by people indigenous to this place.
With gratitude and unity, we acknowledge the relationships to the land and all its beings, and the songs, stories, and teachings of the Siska Nation, the Piikani Nation, the Kayani Nation, and the Ithka Stony Nakota Nation, consisting of the Shiniki, Bearspaw, and Goodstoney Nations, the people of the Tsuna Nation, and the Métis.
In this episode, we heard about how current and future generations can sustainably adopt innovative practices to make a difference in the world. Indigenous communities have been using traditional practices to sustain their lands for generations already, and we need to make sure that practices we adopt now and into the future take into consideration the harm that has been done and how we can work to fix it.
Thank you for listening, and always remember to be mindful of how your actions can affect the future.